From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we talk about the successes and failures of Governor Rick Snyder, including the Flint water crisis.
He will be haunted by it for years to come.
Then an exit interview with Congressman Sander Levin about how politics have changed in Washington.
Well, it's changed a lot in the 36 years I've been in the Congress.
Nancy Kaffer with the Free Press and Joel Kurth with Bridge Magazine talk about the big stories of 2018.
You had the supposed great fixer, John Engler, coming in to clean up the problem and doubling it down and making it worse.
In other states, when your property is auctioned, the county does not pocket the difference between what you owe and what the auction price was.
And we've got recommendations for gifts, books by Michigan authors. All of that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and today for Cynthia Canty. This week, Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes wrote a column on the legacy of Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. I want to read a line from it, quote, "It's a mixed legacy, replete with breakthrough successes and career-marring failures." So, Daniel, what are some of those breakthrough successes?
Well, I think clearly Michigan has got a more competitive tax environment. Its budgeting is much more disciplined. We have a governor who understands Michigan's role in the global economy and is very aggressive in going after that. I think if I were to pinpoint one thing that was really critical to the success of his term, it would be the Detroit bankruptcy. Probably no governor, Republican or Democrat, going back as far as you can think, would have pushed a city like Detroit towards a bankruptcy and then supported it throughout the process and then come through on the other side with consensual deals that, frankly, no one who knew anything about the process would have believed possible. I mean, in 13, 14, 15 months, consensual deals, every union in the city has collective bargaining agreements, and the list could go on and on and on.
Well, let's go back and talk about tax restructuring just for a second, because mm-hmm. that was a really big deal at the time, because we had this horrible tax structure before, and he basically said, here's what we're going to do, and the legislature said, okay.
Well, there clearly were some controversial components to it, and people, I think, still believe that we've got a flat corporate tax of, I believe it's 6%, which makes Michigan very competitive from a business standpoint, but also the so-called retirement tax on pensions of public employees.
Right.
And it's very controversial. A lot of people, in fact, Gretchen Whitmer and Bill Schuette both said that they would repeal it if elected governor, and it would knock about a $300 million hole in the budget. But I think it raises an interesting question that I like to put to people, which is, okay, if I live next door to you and I have to pay taxes on my 401k when I retire, why should you not have to pay taxes on your pensions? And I think that's one of the conundrums that people will have to deal with. And frankly, the governor made the argument, we all have a stake in the future and we all probably have an obligation to pay, which I think, frankly, makes more sense.
I'll just point out that navigating Detroit through the municipal bankruptcy was also not without its controversies, including the emergency manager's law, which was repealed and restored over the
will
of the people. I did a piece several years ago about how much a governor can really affect the state's economy, and mm-hmm. the judgment of the economist was, really not all that much. So how much credit do you think Governor Snyder deserves for the low unemployment rate, the better economy, and what he calls the Michigan comeback?
That's a great question. I would tend to agree with the experts that you talk to. You know, history has a way of dealing cards, if you will, to leaders. Economic cycles. I mean, Jennifer Granholm, governor, when the bottom falls out, the global financial meltdown comes along, General Motors and Chrysler go into federally induced bankruptcy, suppliers are in bankruptcy. It was a train wreck. Was that her fault? No, it wasn't her fault. And I've written that column several times. But you do have options as a leader of how you respond to situations. I think you can't look at Snyder's tenure and say, oh, he's responsible for it. However, there were things that I think he was able to do from a policy perspective that made Michigan more attractive. And we talked about taxes. Another one that I think is really critical is he was very aggressive in going after business investment around the world and very successful. His predecessor, Jennifer Granholm, never once in 8 years went to China. China is vying for the United States as the largest economy. Its auto industry is looking to move outside of it, of the country itself, and move into the United States and in Europe, but particularly the United States. Snyder understood that. I think he went somewhere between 7 and 9 times in 8 years. So there were things he was able to affect on the margins, and essentially to hook his wagon, if you will, from a policy perspective, to what was going on nationally, and understanding that there's a period in time here where you can make some changes. Number one, when your party has got control of the legislature, and number two, when you've got a buoyant economic environment that enables you to do some things that you might not otherwise be able to do if times are tougher.
Let's look at the flip side of the legacy of Rick Snyder. You write the Flint water crisis will be a permanent stain on the Snyder years. What's the depth and breadth of that stain?
It's clearly going to be the single biggest mark against him in his tenure. You mentioned the emergency manager law. I think in the case of Detroit, it was very successful in the way it worked in terms of the person that he put in the job who was not invested locally, who came in from Washington, did a job, and left. That was not the case in Flint, and I think the governor compounded problems with some of the emergency managers he put in charge, a lot of whom were part of the Flint political ecosystem, and then not reacting to very early signs that something was really wrong in Flint. And I remember writing at the time that I think a more politically minded governor, Republican or Democrat, Granholm or Engler, doesn't matter, would have, I think, clearly recognized the peril of dirty, stinking water in a city like Flint and said, I don't care what the science says. We got to go fix this problem, and we got to fix it now. Instead, the governor sat back and was very much Rick Snyder, which is the guy who looks at the data, who makes a calm assessment, and then figures out and charts a path forward. That was not going to work in Flint. He was hobbled by it, and I think he will be haunted by it for years to come. The incoming chair of the House Oversight Committee, Elijah Cummings from Maryland, has already said, I'm not done with Flint. I want more information, and come January, we're going to have hearings.
You also talked about our bone-jarring roads in Michigan. I mean, when he pushed for more funding, even with a majority in the legislature, most of them had signed no tax increase pledges and only gave the governor about half of what he said was needed to fix the roads. So what did that failure reveal about Snyder?
That he doesn't wield political power very effectively, and that he's not feared by his own party. I think if we look back in the history, recent history of Michigan, if had that been John Engler and his party controlled the legislature, do you think he would have been more successful? I think we both would agree that he would have been. I think however you look at Snyder's tenure with his own party in control for the entire 8 years, they could have been much more of a juggernaut than they ultimately were. And that's because I think Snyder, in a lot of ways, was a very moderate, John Kasich-like Republican in a Republican legislature that was definitely more Trumpist in terms of the way it was leaning and Tea Party and the way it looks at things. And as a result, they had the same party affiliation, but they really were two totally different cats.
So let's bottom line this. Successes and failures. What do you think of Snyder's job as governor?
I think he did a pretty good job on the financial and economic sides of things and restructuring both of government and certainly what he did in Detroit. I think politically, in a political senses, left a lot wanting, and I think that's one of the major contributors to what happened in Flint and some of the other things that were not dealt with effectively. And you didn't mention one other thing that I think is really, really important, and that is on Rick Snyder's watch, educational attainment of public school kids across Michigan, not just in the urban areas, has dropped like a stone. And that is also going to be part of his legacy. And frankly, the Republican Party that was in control of the legislature, they've not been able to come up with a formula or an approach that really starts to stop the decline and start to move attainment up in school districts all across the state.
Daniel Howes is columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News. Always good talking to you.
Thanks, Lester.
A quick note, we did reach out to Governor Rick Snyder for an interview. He declined our request. As Traverse City grows, its tree canopy is shrinking. Lately, the city is trying to prevent this within the city limits, but no one can agree on the best way to accomplish that. At the same time, a bill during lame duck has already passed the Senate, and it would block local governments from prohibiting tree removal in certain areas. Interlock and Public Radio's Mac Johnston has more.
Right now, it's relatively easy to cut down trees in Traverse City. You'll need a permit to do it on public property, but if you buy a lot for development, cut away. Brianne B. lives in Traverse City. She says she used to enjoy the view from her backyard.
past my backyard, there was more trees and stuff like that. It was maybe like more of like an open field, some trees. So it was nice. And I come home one day and I look out my back window and I'm like, oh, it's all gone. It's all been knocked down. So
the lot right behind her home was cleared for a real estate project.
So yeah, this is the backyard now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's still pretty.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nicer in the summertime. There's more coverage. You know, I'm not going to see that.
Lots like this one near Breanne's home are becoming more common in Traverse City. According to one study, the area around Grand Traverse Bay has lost over 4,000 acres of tree cover since 2001. For a waterfront area like Traverse City, that can have a serious impact. It hurts air quality, shorelines, and property values. Christine Christman is the executive director of the Watershed Center Grand Traverse Bay in Traverse City.
There is a public benefit to having trees, whether they're on private property or public property. There's not a lot left in our urban core, and I feel like this stuff needs to be protected, and it needs to be protected soon.
The city has tried to remedy some of this by replanting trees and drafting tree protection rules. Rules like tree cutting limits, protecting historic trees, and watering requirements.
It's really trying to get away from clearing lots or from taking some of the really big trees and all the benefits that they provide without replacing them.
Christman says Traverse City needs these rules to protect trees, but others say not so fast.
The more I looked at it, the more I recognized that it would be commercial property owners who would be bearing the ultimate weight of paying for the cost of tree replacement.
That's Kent Wood from the Traverse Area Chamber of Commerce. He says tree replacement and watering requirements would be expensive for developers. Wood says they're all for tree protection, but not quite what the task force recommended.
You know, maybe there's education opportunities or opportunities for the city to assist property owners without having to go right to a tree tax, basically, where you're charging people to replace trees that they've cut down.
And he says when the rules were put together, they weren't involved in the process. That's different now. The city is basically redrafting the rules with more people at the table. For the next few months, they'll hold public meetings and input sessions on what tree protection will look like. But all this may be for nothing. There's a bill that passed through the state Senate last month that basically says cities can't stop people from cutting down trees, at least most of them. It would bar cities from passing tree protection rules, like what's being debated in Traverse City. The bill's sponsor says private property owners should be able to do what they want with their trees. Back at Breanne B's house, she says there's been less wildlife since those trees were cut down. Some nearby residents have had issues with stormwater runoff and their basements flooding. Breanne says she hasn't had to deal with that, but she misses her trees.
I don't know. I wish they didn't need to cut all those trees down, I don't think, but you know. So that's one of the things I liked about the property when I bought it.
When construction on the lot is completed, it will have over 90 homes. A flyer advertising what the neighborhood will look like shows the streets lined with trees. For Stateside, I'm Max Johnston.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Well, we're deep now into the holiday gift-buying season, and never let it be said that your friends at Stateside didn't try to help you out. Presenting Michigan books that would make great gifts. And who better to curate this list than some librarians? Stateside's Cynthia Canty sat down with two librarians to get their takes. Tim Gleisner, manager of special collections at the Library of Michigan, and Jessica Trotter from the Capital Area District Library. Take a listen.
I want to start with your picks for nonfiction, because you both landed on something that everyone knows about, and that is the Flint water crisis. Jessica, what's your pick?
My pick was What the Eyes Don't See by Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha.
Okay, and we had her on Stateside talking about that book. It is terrific. Tim, what's your pick?
My pick is The Poison City by Anna Clark.
Also on Stateside and very, very good. Why did you pick these books? What did you like about these books? And I'm wondering what insights you got into this widely covered story. Jessica?
Well, for me, What the Eyes Don't See is both that biography part of it appealed to me, hearing about Dr. Mona's life, immigrant experience. There's a little bit of genealogy in there. There's just a lot to it, but I also really appreciated the inside look at the crisis.
And Tim, what made you pick Anna Clark's book?
I think for me, it really was just the background of the whole crisis, of the history of the city, of the region, of urban areas across the country, and, you know, the disinvestment from areas like Flint and how it led to that crisis, plus the, I guess, you know, the background politics that went into the whole making of the tragedy that is the Flint water crisis. And so for me, that whole background was really what just grabbed me right from the very beginning.
Jessica, tell us about your historical fiction pick and why you chose this one.
That was Across the Great Lake by Lee Zacharias. It was just a really, it was a surprise find for me. It's a University of Wisconsin publication, but it's a really interesting story. It's an 85-year-old woman looking back on a major turning point in her childhood. And it's a haunting story. It takes place, she goes on a voyage with her father who ferries train cars in the 1930s on Lake Michigan. And it's just a nice look back and forth. I mean, both looking back at that time when she was five and looking over her life in the meantime, too.
And Plying Lake Michigan is our Michigan angle there.
Mm-hmm.
Tim, what's your adult fiction pick?
Mine is Beautiful Music by Michael Zadorian. And for me, it's just a fantastic book. It was a book that I could not put down. It's set in late 60s, early 70s Detroit. A family that's going through incredible dysfunction, divorce, well, not divorce, but just, you know, the death of a father, and just really just the universal theme of father and son bonding, in this case, the music of the time. And then just basically a beautiful, beautiful take on this boy's life as he's growing up in high school in Detroit. And just as, you know, things are disintegrating in the city, it is with his life as well. And just a very compelling read overall.
And I will second your pick because we had Michael on Stateside to talk about Beautiful Music, and he so beautifully captured what it was like to be in Detroit in the 70s and the music.
Yes.
Taking you through the music. Yeah, that was a really
and
good
for one. Me, it was a real personal angle because it was, you know, I grew up almost, you know, I was a contemporary of this character in this book. And my father and I had the same bond over music, driving around, just listening to radio stations. And it was just, I mean, it was just a touching, touching work for myself.
And what is your adult nonfiction pick, Tim?
Well, you know, I would look at one that I would say is called Notes from a Public Typewriter by the Literati Bookstore in Ann Arbor. And to me, this was like Jessica, she had her surprise find. This to me was just a beautiful, beautiful book. It's basically a compilation at the Literati Bookstore. They have a old-fashioned typewriter that's laid out for anybody to be able to type little vignettes, all their customers and whoever else might be passing by. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece of what I would call community placemaking. All the community coming in, collaborating, and they've basically taken all those vignettes from the community and put it into this book, beautifully edited. And honestly, it was such a surprise because at first I thought, oh, what a gimmick. I'm not going to like it. I don't want to read it. And then when I picked it up and I read it and read all the different pieces in it, it was just something that just grabbed me right from the start. And what's amazing, all these bookstores around the state now are starting to emulate and copy this whole thing from Frankfort all the way down to Grand Rapids. It's just an amazing thing.
It pulls at the heartstrings. I'm glad you put Notes from a Public Typewriter in there. Jessica, what is your adult graphic novel pick?
Oh, that's Abbott by Saladin Ahmed. He's a Detroit-based fantasy author, is how he came to my attention. This is a gritty supernatural crime thriller set in 1970s Detroit. And it features a dogged journalist investigating horrific crimes that are similar to those that happened, something that happened in her past. It's a really neat look at the time from the point of view of a Black woman. She's a Black female journalist, and I'm just really hoping to see more out there from him on her.
Very good. Who would you recommend this for?
It is an adult graphic novel. It's you know, if you ever were interested in X-Files or Kolchak, that old sci-fi horror TV show, those are the types of things. I mean, it's just, or Stranger Things, or, you know, those types of people who enjoy those shows.
Tim, you've got a pick for poetry.
Yeah, so it's a different type of poetry. It's actually a story told in poems. And being somebody who grew up on Lake Michigan, loves Lake Michigan, returns to Lake Michigan any chance he gets, it's a book called The Lake Michigan Mermaid, and it's by Linda Nemec Foster and Anne-Marie Ooman, illustrated by Meredith Riddle. And it's a tale in poems about this young lady on the shores of Lake Michigan, presumably maybe southwestern Michigan. And again, unfortunately, her life is falling apart because of her parents' divorce and her grandmother is slowly dying. And essentially, a mythology is created about a supposed mermaid. And again, a surprise, something that I would not typically pick up. This is not something that I would go out of my way to look at, but I saw it, I was intrigued. And again, just you can tell the love for Lake Michigan in this book. And being somebody who has that similar feeling for that place, something that really just kind of grabbed me and just wouldn't let go until I put it down.
And Jessica Trotter, you've got a couple picks for younger readers. Let's start with your choice for children's picture book.
The children's picture book I pick is So Tall Within. It's by the text is by Gary Schmidt and the art is by Daniel Minter. Gary Schmidt's primarily, I think of him as a middle grade author, but this is a picture book biography of Sojourner Truth. And it sort of has a few different parts to it. It sort of has a song that develops on the left-hand side of the pages. It's got the story on the right-hand side of the pages. It's going through the good and bad of her life from slavery to her freedom with her settling in Battle Creek. And really, the illustrations are absolutely stunning.
Wonderful. And finally, for middle school readers.
Drum roll, please. I think this is kind of an under-the-radar one for a lot of people. This is by Lisa Jen Bigelow. It's about a 13-year-old percussionist who is going off. She got talked into by what her best friend going to something called Camp Rockaway, sort of a rock band camp. Anybody who ever went to band camp, Blue Lake, Interlaken, anything like that, it just has that feel of it so much. And it's set in that same general area. And it's just a kid trying to find herself, find her own voice. She tends to be the follower, but she's a drummer, and she just needs to find her own beat and make her own noise.
Well, this is a great list of giftable Michigan books, and we want to thank Tim Gleisner, Manager of Special Collections at the Library of Michigan, and Jessica Trotter from the Capital Area District Library. We've put their full list up for you so you could print it off and take it shopping for your holiday gifts at the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Great talking books with both of you, and thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
After 36 years in Congress, Sander Martin Levin is leaving office. U.S. Representative Levin joins us now for, well, let's call it an exit interview. Congressman Levin, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thanks. I'm here in Washington. We're supposed to finish today, and that would mean the last day of my 36 years on the floor of the House or in the Congress. But as always, you can't be entirely sure about what's going to happen.
Right. Serving that long, I wonder, over the decades, how has Congress changed?
Well, it's changed a lot in the 36 years I've been in the Congress. It's been changed in terms of personal relationships or the lack of them. When I first came, so many of the people had families, including children, in Washington, and we got to know each other away from the Capitol. And it really affected, I think, how people debated. There could be intense disagreement, but it was hard to be uncivil to a colleague whom you knew personally, whose spouses you knew, and in many cases, whose children.
I want to ask you about your career. I was reading in the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press when you first announced you were retiring or leaving Congress. You talked about defeating the privatization of Social Security. Why was that a major highlight of your career?
Because President Bush wanted to privatize it, and I was asked by the leadership here to move away, at least for a while, from the Trade Subcommittee, where I was ranking member, to be ranking on Social Security because it was so critical in the lives of millions and millions of people, people who were seniors, people who were disabled, etc. And we worked at it, and sometimes people said, well, we need to have an alternative to privatization. And the leadership and I always said, no way, we're going to really keep the focus on what it means today, not on various forms of privatization. And that worked. We had town meetings, hundreds and hundreds throughout the country, and I held town hall meetings in the district. And it was really interesting that the seniors were the ones who were most outspoken. Their Social Security wasn't going to be threatened. But I can remember so vividly at one town hall meeting, I don't remember her name, of course, but I can still, there were maybe 100, 125 people there. I can just remember this woman getting up and saying, look, I know I'll keep my Social Security. I want to make sure my children and grandchildren have that same opportunity that they worked for.
Tell me about your role in helping to rescue the auto industry when GM and Chrysler were in big trouble.
Well, I think our role in Congress was absolutely critical. Some people said, you know, they've made mistakes, let them sink. And we said, no, this goes back to my experience. I once worked at Dodge Maine when I was a student. And I knew in those days what industrial work meant to people. In essence, the auto industry, more perhaps than any other factor, made the middle class of America. And so we just felt passionately about it. And I'm glad that we took the steps to make sure that the big three continued.
Your son, Andy Levin, is representative-elect for your congressional district. And I'm wondering how you think you're going to deal with that. Will you be calling? Will there be temptation there to offer advice, even if it's unsolicited?
No, I think it would be very unusual where there'd be unsolicited advice. He ran on his own merits. I think those merits are very, very strong. He's had a lot of leadership opportunity and job training. I just received today an announcement of his latest green energy development. He's become a solar energy entrepreneur. And he just announced the latest commercial entity that was going to convert to solar energy and save a lot of money. And it's more sound in terms of global warming. He also put together the best job training program in the country when he was working as assistant director of the labor and then the labor and energy department.
Let's talk about what it's going to mean to Michigan to lose another veteran lawmaker. I mean, we lost your brother, Senator Carl Levin. He retired in 2015. We've lost a lot of other members of Congress in the last few years. In fact, the only ones you could really call veterans anymore might be Fred Upton and Debbie Stabenow. Without many long-serving members at all, how will that affect representation for Michigan?
I think it will have an impact. I can think back, for example, when I represented a part of Detroit and Dearborn Heights and Inkster, when I worked with Bill Ford and John Dingell on cleaning up the Rouge River. And we were able, with the help also of Bob Traxler, to provide millions and millions of dollars to try to clean up the Rouge River. You know, my beloved mother was born in Birmingham in 1898. She used to swim in the Rouge River in the Birmingham area. She swam in that river. As they said, years later, you could almost walk on it. You never dream of swimming it. So for me, it was something personal, but I thought for the people I represented, something really, really, really significant. So seniority matters, but the people who are coming here from Michigan are really very talented people, in addition to my son, whom, of course, I know, and we've always been very close. We're proud of our close family, but I'm also sure that the others who are coming in will be Haley and Alyssa and Rashida. They'll be strong, strong members.
Sandra Levin is a member of Congress and leaving office after 36 years of service. Thanks for taking the day on this last voting day for you.
Well, it's an emotional day for me, and I really welcome the opportunity. And let me close by just saying something that I said at a gathering last weekend in Warren, and that is the importance of public service. And I think what we need to do is to renew our faith, because for me, and I do finish with this, public service is a continuation of a sense of community that was so strong in our family. And what I did was to take the sense of community from my grandparents who came over as immigrants, my parents who were born in the U.S., who had a strong sense of community, who felt you had to expand it and really outreach to everybody and have that same sense of community apply to the broader community. So I've been privileged to serve, as I said last weekend, in the public arena, and I hope I've been a good public servant.
Congressman Levin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Still to come, breaking down the biggest news stories in Michigan for 2018.
Access to water is not a frivolous thing. It's sort of a hallmark of civilization.
I see water as the predominant issue in Michigan's future for the next century.
A little taste of what we'll hear from Nancy Kaffer of the Detroit Free Press and Joel Kurth of Bridge Magazine. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. With 2018 wrapping up, we thought we'd take a look back at some of the year's biggest stories, and I'm not going to make that decision, so I've got some folks in here to help me with that task. Nancy Kaffer is a columnist, a member of the editorial board at the Free Press. Joel Kurth is managing editor at Bridge Magazine. Nancy, let's start with you. Biggest stories of 2018.
Okay. The biggest story of 2018, and in fact, every year of the last, like, two, 3 decades, and probably the next two, 3 decades going forward, is Detroit Public Schools. We have the largest student population in the state in the city of Detroit. We have traditional public schools. We have charter schools. Across the board are not performing to an adequate level. There is no mystery about this. There is not even really a mystery about what we need to do to improve student performance. Study after study has said you have to spend more money to educate at-risk kids, kids who live in poverty, kids who are learning English, kids with special needs, which we have a higher population
of in
Detroit.
That's not what the Republicans in the legislature say, though.
And yet, interesting. I wonder where their children go to school. So we have this large student population that is being horribly underserved, not getting the education these students are entitled to. And year after year, we just kind of go, huh, well, that's too bad.
Well, no, year after year, you have, every 5 years, you have a new plan.
Right,
a new
right.
superintendent yeah. and a new holistic plan. We're going to roll. It's like the Lions,
yeah,
basically.
We're
going to tear it all down and start over again.
We're very, very comfortable with using Detroit children as sort of experimental subjects in the latest plan du jour about how to fix education.
Poverty lab.
Joel, your number one story for 2018.
I got to go with the continued fallout and horror show that is Michigan State University in the wake of the Larry Nassar criminal enterprise going on there. I mean, you know, it's started the year with the president stepping down, ending it with the president, Lou Anna Simon, getting charged with 4 felonies. In between, you had the supposed great fixer, John Engler, coming in to clean up the problem and doubling it down and making it worse by bungling a $500 million settlement to 350 victims of sexual assault. I mean, it doesn't get much worse, and I feel like it's yet another example in Michigan that we've seen in the past few years of just shattering public trust in cherished institutions. It goes back to Flint. Now the largest public university is just embroiled in scandal, and you don't know when it's going to end.
John Engler, you know, he hasn't really been in public life since, what, 2000?
They went to the Wayback Machine for that.
He must have been so surprised to find that you can't publicly trash victims of sexual assault anymore.
Right.
It's not okay anymore.
The rules have changed a little bit.
Yeah. Is what a shock.
I don't think he got the memo.
Like a bucket of cold water.
But it was
in
like
the
they were going to bring in Tony Soprano to fix the sexual assault problem.
It was your former colleague and my Daniel Howells at the Detroit News, who is a guy who is a very strongly rooted in the business community, brings a strong business lens to the commentary he gives. And Howells said, this is the wrong choice, the wrong pick, the wrong guy. Engler is not the person to fix this mess. And I just wish they had listened to him.
It was eyebrow raising from the get-go, because it was, as you said, it was like from the Wayback Machine, and it was from a different era. And it shows, again, how tone deaf and how out of step the people who are making the decisions at MSU are. And you know, I just go back to the fact that it's like, well, like my family goes to has all graduated from MSU. And it's just this, it occupies a huge place in people's heart. To speak nothing of the victims, but it's just people can't look at it the same again, and they haven't righted the ship yet.
Well, and you say it's been botched from day one. You know, PR experts say the thing that MSU should have done was say, we messed up. We're going to figure out how to become a national leader.
Like Pennsylvania did.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
A national leader in having a safe campus. They didn't do that. They have just been weird about the whole thing. That you have a lot of people on the board who seem very invested in the idea that their presence on the board is integral, and former President Simon's leadership of the university was somehow integral to the success of the institution. And that, I think, happens when people are in place for too long. Sometimes they confuse their success with the success of the institution. You should never be the linchpin of your institution's success. If that's the case, you're doing it wrong.
Well, the mentality always from the get-go, from the start, was that they were going to protect the institution first, and the victims were always sort of an afterthought. So I think you had a bunker mentality going into it that just doubled down.
But that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the institution was. The institution wasn't them and their reputations and their ability to lead it. The institution is the people who comprise it, and that includes the victims of this assault. That includes the families like yours who are invested in it. That includes future, current students, past students. I mean, and again, these victims. An institution is made up of people. It's not some, you know, artificial entity that isn't. I mean, it's they seem to have that deep misunderstanding.
It's not Luana Simon and company and Joel Ferguson and the crew. It's 40,000 people plus exponentially more alumni plus the victims plus their families plus. I mean, you know, you talk about 6 degrees of separation in Michigan. It's 2 degrees of separation with Michigan State.
I'll make 2 points about that. Number one, they made this a much, much worse story for the media to grab hold of it. And, you know, it could have been something that lasted 3 or 4 months. And instead, it's just continuing and will continue. The other thing is, I want to put in a plug for my colleagues at Michigan Radio who put together this podcast called Believed. If you've not heard Believed, I really encourage you. You cannot understand this Nassar scandal and how he got away with this for so long without hearing this. It's appalling in some ways and really just breathtaking in others.
You guys have done outstanding reporting on this whole thing along the way. It's been very difficult to listen to a lot of it, but really instructive.
It's great. It's a horror show.
Let's go to your number two story of 2018.
The number two, also a story that's a big story every year, the Wayne County tax foreclosure auction.
Yeah.
We had a lot of movement on that this year. Well, that's probably the wrong way to put it. We had a lot more attention of maybe a kind that suggests that people are waking up to the fact that this is an ongoing disaster for Detroit and Wayne County. We haven't really had any movement on fixing it, but the first step is to understand it's a problem.
Fixing it at the government level, because there are a lot of volunteer groups out there trying to help people.
There absolutely are, and this is what's so frustrating about it. I wrote a column several months ago saying they just needed to stop having the auction, because there have been millions, if not billions by now, of dollars put in to blunting the devastating impacts of this auction. you know, volunteer groups, wonderful, wonderful saint-like people who work tirelessly to try to keep people in their homes, people who are foreclosed on for really paltry sums of money and who this foreclosures do devastating damage to Detroit neighborhoods. And but all this work to try to make the auction not be harmful, it's like taking a very sharp knife and trying to wrap it in bubble wrap. At the end of the day, it's still a knife, and you've had a lot of effort to try to make the knife not be harmful. But, like, maybe let's just put down the knife.
I've lost track of how many foreclosures there have been since 2003. At one point, it was one in three houses in Detroit have been mm-hmm. foreclosed. I'm sure it's much more than that now. What I find appalling about that situation, and as well as the Detroit water shutoff situation, is the lack of attention being paid to it by other groups. As you said, there's small volunteer groups, but there's nothing on an institutional level. Like, for instance, I don't necessarily fault the county treasurer for trying to collect taxes. I think he could do a lot better job at it. I think he's done a poor job at it, as a fact. But his job is to collect the money. But there's not a larger effort from foundations or charities or other big groups to try to step in and identify this as a problem. You're asking the tax man to solve a societal problem, and I think that's a fundamental mistake.
And the tax man's been asking the legislature to change the law so he doesn't have to follow the law.
But this is one of the problems. One of the problems is that there's this round robin of blamesmanship, right? The treasurer goes, oh, I have to have the auction. The law requires me to. And then the legislature says, oh, this is a local issue. I mean, there's this sort of passing of the buck here. And, you know, one of the things that someone pointed out to me that's so mysterious about how this auction goes is you drive around the city, see all these signs up about how you can get on a payment plan, how you can pay your taxes. How much information do you see that helps people understand how to pay their taxes on time? It's like the whole system is set up that once you are in foreclosure, there's this limited array of tools to help you.
Well, as you know, the dirty little secret in Wayne County is that the tax foreclosure helps balance the budget.
Yep.
And, you know, it was interesting that Warren Evans, when he was sheriff of Wayne County, called for a moratorium on mortgage foreclosures during the mortgage meltdown. But now that he is the treasurer, he's been...
County executive.
Mm-hmm. I promise not to lie today for at least 18 minutes. But he's been silent, basically silent, mm-hmm. Ever since he took office.
So there's actually a lawsuit working its way up to the Michigan Supreme Court right now that has worked its way to the Michigan Supreme Court, filed on behalf of an Oakland County property owner whose home was foreclosed on for like $8 or something and then auctioned off for $20,000+. In other states, when your property is auctioned, the county does not pocket the difference between what you owe and what the auction price was. The reason that the auction is so lucrative for Wayne County is because in Michigan, the treasurer's office is able to collect, if you owe $500 and your house auctions for $3,000, the treasurer gets to keep not just the value of the back taxes and some fees and stuff, but that whole sum. In other states, the difference is remitted to the former property owner. So that would be a good step. This lawsuit, if the Michigan Supreme Court rules in the favor of the property owners, could really upend the whole auction system statewide. So when I say that I'm seeing some movement this year that makes me hopeful that we're going to potentially get somewhere, there's just little things like that happen. Little things. A big lawsuit at the Michigan Supreme Court. Little thing. But we're seeing some things happen that suggest that there's possibility.
Let's go with your number two story.
Water everywhere. It's really poisoned. if you ask anyone in Michigan what makes Michigan great, it's the Great Lakes. It's the abundance of fresh water around us. But we've seen continual assaults on our fresh water from Nestle up north extracting, I don't know how many gallons a minute of
all
water.
The gallons.
Over the protest of 80,000 people. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You've had the PFAS chemical contaminations that are popping up everywhere. You have the Line 5 controversy over the gas pipeline going through the most beautiful spot in Michigan, the Straits of Mackinac. You have continual problems replacing lead pipes in Flint and this ongoing catastrophe, I think, of water shutoffs in Detroit, where you've seen it's down now from 30,000 a year to 10,000 a year. I did an article recently that shows that you still have upwards of 5,000 people whose water got shut off this year that don't have water 3 months later. So I think, we're starting to see this just continual assault on water. And you know, Nancy said that it's going to be an issue. Detroit schools are going to be an issue for 20 years. I see water as the predominant issue in Michigan's future for the next century.
I could not agree with you more. And I think it's great reporting, by the way, because one of the things that has been particularly hard for me to figure out is how many people just lost water and have never had it restored. I don't know that they track that. They have not done a great job of tracking completion of payment plans. They like to talk really about how many people get on payment plans, but that doesn't tell you how many people complete them, how many people return to them after they have cleared one debt. And this is access to water is not it's not like a frivolous thing. It's sort of a hallmark of civilization.
Right. You know, when I see the bills, I hear about the bills out of Detroit, out of Flint, out of Ypsilanti, for that matter, and I compare them to my bills, I'm thinking, man, that's what happens when you abandon a city and you have all that infrastructure left behind. You've got this huge, huge amount of funds going into nothing.
That is true, but if we make this solely an urban poor issue, I think we're really neglecting a lot of root causes. You're seeing communities, rich communities like Oxford, Michigan, and Oakland County, whose water bills have quadrupled in the past year. Water bills are on the rise 20% nationwide. This is going to be something that's going to approach a cable bill pretty soon.
And the reality is we built out all these water systems in the 70s and a time when there was all this federal money to build these things. That doesn't exist anymore. So we build a bunch of stuff. Now we have to pay to maintain it. No one really wants to do that. And that's kind of a problem all around. That's a problem with schools. It's a problem with roads. It's a problem with water. Is nobody wants to spend money to make stuff work like we feel like it should.
Well, building stuff is fun, but maintaining it sucks.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to. Yeah, nobody likes fixing their plumbing. It's not like buying a new sofa. You don't feel a great feeling of pride when you flush your toilet and it does what it ought to. But at the same time, if it doesn't, that's a problem.
Okay, we're running out of time. I really thought we'd be able to get a lot more in. So here's what I want to ask both of you. What stories in 2018 did not get enough attention by reporters?
This is a little off the beaten path, but I think it's 36th District Court in Detroit. This is a court that serves 420,000 cases a year. That's about 1 in 20 Michigan residents. This year, they, among other indignities to defendants, they banned the use of pens in the building because they bought some new artwork. So defendants and people who are in their families can't take notes on their defense or write a note to their attorney. They're not enforcing rental ordinances. They're evicting 40,000 people a year through these rocket dockets, and they also have a new collections system that throws people in jail if they don't pay civil fines.
Story that's undercovered.
I don't know if this is a Michigan-specific story, but we've seen a lot of coverage in the last year and a half of the Me Too movement of women speaking out against high-profile accusers or assaulters who, in some cases, have lost their careers, whether for a short or a long term. But what we don't hear a lot about is, you know, and I'm not trying to minimize the impacts of assault or harassment, no matter what level of a profession you're at. If you're it's just as degrading and awful. If you're doing all right financially, it's still a horrible experience to go through. But what we don't still have is a way for, like, if you're a lady working like a shift at Arby's whose manager harasses her, we have really yet a way to figure out how to help women who don't have the same kind of privilege and power and resources that some of the more high-profile folks do. And I don't know that we've done a great job of covering what these circumstances are like for women who are far more vulnerable and who have far fewer resources to push back.
The story I'd like to see to get covered more by our colleagues is the fact that we've got a legislature, a term-limited legislature, from a variety of different vocations who come in and decide they know more than the educated experts within the agencies do about science and about health and about all these other things, and basically are trying to take away their ability to do their job. I just can't imagine the hubris that's behind that.
There's a great Edgar Allan Poe quote, "I have great faith in fools, self-confidence, my friends call it."
You're saying that politicians have hubris?
What? That is Joel Kurth. He's managing editor at Bridge Magazine. We also heard from Nancy Kaffer. She's a columnist and member of the editorial board at the Free Press. I've really enjoyed this. Next time we do this over beers.
Absolutely. I thought there was beer tonight.
Nope, sorry.
Thanks, Lester.
Thank you.
And remember, we always want to hear from you. We just talked about 2018's big stories, but what are the big stories you'll be watching heading into 2019? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio or on Twitter at Stateside Radio. You can also send your ideas via email to stateside@michiganradio.org. Again, that's stateside@michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joy Horan, Sarah Leeson, and Bella Isaacs. Sorry, Sarah. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.